ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Wednesday, the 10th of April. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people. Today, the Australian government considers recognising Palestinian statehood. How would this major foreign policy shift play out on the world stage? And after 170 years in operation, a renowned live music pub in Adelaide stares down demolition. How much should cultural heritage be part of a development decision?
Lots of people would say, oh, you know, you could just move those gigs somewhere else. At the end of the day, that's not really possible. Venues that are dedicated to doing it and booking bands every night, in Adelaide especially, are running out of time.
The Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, says the international community must build a pathway out of the endless cycle of violence in the Middle East. To do that, she says Australia could recognise a Palestinian state as a first step towards a two-state solution, but she says Hamas would play no role. Her comments have drawn criticism from the Jewish community in Australia, which says any talk of recognition is premature. Alison Shaw reports.
It's not an announcement or a policy pivot, but Foreign Minister Penny Wong's comments are a clearer signal that the Australian government is considering recognising Palestinian statehood.
Recognising a Palestinian state, that one that can only exist side by side with a secure Israel, doesn't just offer the Palestinian people an opportunity to realise their aspirations, it also strengthens the forces for peace. And that is why we are urging all parties to return to the table and why we are engaging.
In a speech at the Australian National University's Security Conference in Canberra, Senator Wong said this is a step Australia and its allies are now considering as a move towards a two-state solution. She argued the decision would undermine extremism and Hamas, and that Hamas would have no role in a future Palestinian state. The question on whether to recognise Palestinian statehood has been fiercely contested within the Labor Party. Asked this morning if Australia is ready and willing to change its position, Senator Wong was clear.
We've made no such decision. The discussion I want to have is to look at what is happening in the international community, where there is the very important debate about how it is we secure long-lasting peace.
Her speech has been welcomed by Australia-Palestine Advocacy Network President Nasser Mashni, but he says action on this is overdue.
It's past time for us just to unilaterally do it and join 139 other like-minded countries and bestow and agree that Palestinians deserve self-determination.
The opposition has criticised the timing of the address, Shadow Foreign Affairs Minister Simon Birmingham labelling the comments dangerous.
What Penny Wong seems to be suggesting is some type of fast-tracked or preemptive recognition of Palestinian statehood, and that's completely the wrong approach to be taking at present. Indeed, it's a dangerous approach to be taking when right now in ceasefire negotiations in Cairo, the pressure should be being put on Hamas to immediately release hostages, and that's where the real pressure should be being applied.
And he cast doubt on the senator's claims that Hamas would have no role in a Palestinian state recognised by Australia.
So then how is that achieved? Because these things are easy to say, but to be simultaneously urging for a ceasefire that would seem to leave Hamas in place is, of course, not going to achieve the type of outcome or environment for a two-state solution to be negotiated.
The Executive Council of Australian Juries CEO Alex Rivchen says Penny Wong's comments are misguided.
The only time we can begin to talk about a two-state solution is firstly with the demise of Hamas. But everything has its time, everything has its place, and this is not the time to talk about a two-state solution.
Ben Scott is a senior advisor at the National Security College. He says Israelis and Palestinians seem more divided on what a two-state solution would look like than ever before, despite growing agreement in the international community.
If we were to build on this idea of recognising a Palestinian state, and before it really exists, before it really controls territory and has self-government, and get some more agreement on what the contents of that would look like, then that would be a step forward, I think. If we do do build a bigger international coalition, we can change the factors that shape both parties and prompt more concessions on both sides.
Meanwhile, in Cairo, protracted ceasefire talks between Hamas and Israel continue.
Alison Schau. The Foreign Minister's comments have already provoked a divisive response in Australia, but how will they be interpreted on the international stage? Bob Bowker is a former Australian ambassador to Jordan, Egypt and Syria. Bob Bowker, should the Australian government recognise Palestinian statehood?
I support recognition of a Palestinian state, in the UN context at least, as an affirmation that our values apply in our approach to dealings between states as well as within states. I think it should be a lower order priority for us than seeking an immediate and durable end to the conflict in Gaza and the return of hostages and the defence of UNRWA, but it has merit in principle.
Penny Wong, the Foreign Minister, says that the recognition of Palestinian statehood might be a way to build momentum towards a two-state solution for Israel and Palestine. Is that a feasible outcome?
I don't see any prospect of such momentum developing. I think we're generations away from achieving willingness among fearful Israelis and radicalised Palestinians to think about the consequences of their existing trajectories, even though their future probably depends on finding within their respective societies the determination to move beyond hatred and apathy and righteous victimhood and all the other problems that have seen the carnage in of recent months in Gaza. But what's important for us, I think, is to focus on protecting our interests and values in the void of neither two states nor one state into which both the Israelis and the Palestinians are now staring, probably for decades and possibly for generations to come.
She says that the only way that this idea could proceed is if Hamas is not part of any Palestinian state. What's your response to that?
Well, I would that it were true. Hamas is a despicable organisation and it must take prime responsibility for setting back the Palestinian cause for decades. But unfortunately, Hamas will emerge in Gaza as the strongest political actor in that particular context. At the moment, Hamas's great advantage is, in fact, the Israeli occupation. The indignities, the humiliation, the absence of opportunity for Palestinians that arises from the occupation is the mainstay of Hamas's identity and its capacity to draw support. And it will draw increased support as a result of the carnage we have seen in Gaza as future generations of Palestinians seek revenge for what has become of themselves and their children.
Why do you think the Australian government would be contemplating this now?
I think it's been in the wind for a considerable time within the Labor Party, but there is also a societal shift in Australia now in regard to the whole question of Israel and Palestine. There is enormous frustration in Australian society when they see the behaviour of Israel vis-a-vis the Palestinians since the 7th of October. I think the sympathy that was rightly due to Israel at that point has largely been overtaken in the public mind by the visual evidence of extreme suffering and privation that has been inflicted upon ordinary Palestinians who had nothing to do with what took place on the 7th of October. And there is this desire, I think, to rebalance our stance, and the Labor Party, quite rightly, is responding to that.
Professor Bob Bowker, thanks for joining the world today.
My pleasure, Rachel.
That's Professor Bob Bowker, a former Australian ambassador to Jordan, Egypt and Syria from the Centre for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Australian National University. On ABC Radio across Australia, this is The World Today. Thanks for your company. A damning review of an autism care provider in Melbourne has found that the National Disability Insurance Scheme's own Safeguard Commission allowed the service to continue operating despite knowing it was using prohibited restraints on children. Last year, the ABC's Four Corners program aired footage of a teenager with autism and intellectual disabilities being restrained on the ground by six workers. It prompted a review of the severe behaviour program run by Irrabina Autism Services in Melbourne. Four Corners journalist Anne Connolly joined me a short time ago.
So we did an investigation into the NDIS, and as part of that we discovered practices at Irrabina Autism Services in Melbourne. They had a severe behaviour program. It was for children with severe disabilities whose families had trouble with their behaviours. They would attend Monday to Fridays, and we discovered that they were being kept in small rooms, windowless rooms, for part of their therapy. And when they had what were called uncontrolled behaviours, therapists would call each other on walkie-talkies to come in to pin children down to the ground. And we obtained video footage of one teenager being subjected to that practice. And that was one of the reasons that the review was commissioned into Irrabina.
So that review was conducted by the former judge Jennifer Boland. What did she find in her review?
Well, first of all, she found that children were put at risk of death and serious harm, that they had their human rights breached. She found that there were systemic failures at the NDIS Commission, that there were many opportunities to act, that there was knowledge that these prohibited practices were happening, but time and again, action wasn't taken. The only action that was taken was education of the executives and the therapists there. But all the while, these children were still being subjected to both prohibited and unauthorised restraints, and that was over a period of about 2 years.
How damning is this for the regulator?
It's a really shocking review, and I must make the point that we've only got a very small section of it. We've got about 10 pages of a 70-page report. The version that we have is quite heavily redacted, so we don't know all of it. In fact, the executive summary isn't even all there, and some of the recommendations have been blanked out as well. But the NDIS Commission recognises how terrible it is because they've issued an apology saying that the children and families were let down.
And have there been any repercussions for the NDIS Commission and Irrabina Autism Services?
So the NDIS Commissioner, Tracy Mackey, who we interviewed for our program, she resigned in February, just as the review was being finished. In terms of what's happening with Irrabina Autism Services, the Commission is still investigating it, and there may be further regulatory action. There have been bans of the ex-CEO and her daughter. But more concerning for some people, the families, for example, is that workers who were part of this program and who did restrain children in this way are believed to be still working in the sector, and there's been no action taken against them.
And what about the families involved here, Anne? Has there been any reaction from them to this review?
So we've spoken to two mothers who took their children to there. They are pleased in one sense that this has come to light. However, they say the review doesn't go far enough. The review has been a look at the regulatory process and the failures. There hasn't been any investigation of the effect on the children, who was restrained. We know that there are videos of these children having been restrained in that particular way, yet many of these families remain in the dark and they want answers, and at least one family is considering legal action.
Anne Connolly there. Fewer dolphins, damage to aquaculture and faster climate change. They're just some of the concerns that Northern Territory scientists and business owners have about a massive gas processing precinct planned for Darwin Harbour. Those parties will give evidence today at a Senate inquiry into the Middle Arm gas and petrochemicals processing precinct. The gas industry says the economic benefits will outweigh the risks. Jane Barden reports.
Over the last decade, marine scientist Carol Palmer has recorded a 50% reduction in Darwin Harbour's dolphins following the construction of two gas plants and a shipping channel. Dr. Palmer will tell a Senate inquiry that the planned new Middle Arm gas and petrochemicals processing precinct and another shipping channel will mean even fewer marine animals.
We now are going to see more and more decline because of all the dredging, the loss of all the underwater habitats.
Dan Richards Aquaculture Farm supplies 45% of Australia's barramundi. He's worried the precinct will threaten his and other fish hatcheries.
Larval stages of aquatic animals are really sensitive to heavy metals and pollutants, so it's really important that new businesses don't get put in at the expense of existing industries.
The NT's Amateur Fishermen's Association fears shipping channel dredging impacts and that access will be blocked to the popular Elizabeth River. Its chief executive, David Chiravolo, is suggesting Middle Arm Precinct companies use Darwin's existing port and gas jetties
before that dredging is done, because the dredging can't be undone.
Royal Darwin Hospital doctors, including paediatrician Louise Woodward, will tell the inquiry they're worried about health impacts. The NT government's preliminary assessment found air quality could be diminished by gas and petrochemicals processing.
Every new project increases the concentration of chemicals which increase the risk of asthma attacks and worsen chronic disease.
A draft social impact consultants report commissioned by the NT Industry Department and seen by the ABC has found all these concerns should be considered medium to high risks by the NT and federal governments. It's found there's a high risk the precinct's greenhouse emissions will stop the NT reaching its 2050 net zero target. The NT Chief Minister Eva Lawler has dismissed concerns.
And I'll be speaking very strongly around how important Middle Arm is to the economy of the Northern Territory.
The NT head of the gas industry's peak body Australian energy producers, David Slama, says a carbon capture storage facility at Middle Arm will deal with many of the greenhouse gas emissions from the precinct.
The Middle Arm will very much play a key part to enable carbon storage, not only for Australian projects, but also for other global operators.
He says he's surprised his body wasn't asked to give evidence at the Greens-led inquiry, but the Greens say gas companies were asked.
Jane Barden reporting. The Federal Treasurer has unveiled a major overhaul of merger laws designed to speed up and streamline the process for corporate takeovers to boost competition and to better protect consumers. Jim Chalmers wants more transparency in the merger process and plans to turbocharge the power of the competition watchdog to ensure big takeovers don't result in monopolies where big companies swallow up smaller businesses. The ABC's senior business correspondent Peter Ryan joined me earlier. Peter, how concerned is Jim Chalmers about the current merger laws given the extent of this shakeup?
Well, Rachel, outlining these reforms in Sydney at an event hosted by the ACCC and the Law Council, Jim Chalmers said there's evidence that competition has gone backwards for the past 20 years and that market concentration has nearly doubled since 2010. He agrees most mergers do have economic benefits, but they can also result in serious economic harm where firms are solely focused on squeezing out competitors where they end up swamping the market. Now, a big feature here is that the ACCC will be given a lot more clout and more funding to better vet and potentially block mergers that aren't in the public interest. Firms will have to prove that any creeping acquisition won't dilute competition and result in higher prices for consumers, and importantly, make it harder for firms to keep matters in the courts using a phalanx of lawyers, consultants, and economists. The backdrop here, of course, is the current pressure on the supermarket giants like Coles and Woolworths in the firing line over their market power, under pressure to sign onto a mandatory code of conduct rather than a voluntary one, and the potential for fines that could run into the billions of dollars. Jim Chalmers says the ACCC will have a greater say in differentiating between harmful and beneficial mergers.
Most mergers have genuine economic benefits. We acknowledge that. But some mergers can cause serious economic harm. This happens when players aren't interested in improving profitability by lifting productivity. When they're solely focused on squeezing out competitors to ensure a bigger percentage of the market. And from that, it's really clear to us that Australia's approach to mergers is no longer fit for purpose. Our voluntary system means the ACCC isn't properly equipped to detect and act against anti-competitive mergers. It has limited visibility of merger activity. It doesn't always see the ones that present the greatest risks to competition.
That's the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers. And Peter, not everyone's a fan of tougher regulation, especially, I imagine, the businesses themselves. Tell us about that.
Well, Rachel, that's right. This has gone down like a lead balloon. The Australian Institute of Company Directors has released its latest Directors Sentiment Index. It's found that directors have become increasingly distrustful of the federal government, being worn down by new regulation. Now, this isn't specifically about changes to merger law we were just speaking about then, but rising concerns about how the government regards businesses. One quote from the index said, rather than new regulation being an irritant, it's now a major concern. The directors are being worn down. They feel like they're punching bags, encountering a wave of a regulatory tsunami. So that director sentiment is negative for the fourth survey in a row, amid worries that tougher regulation will slow down deals, cost more to propose, and potentially harm broader reforms to the economy.
Peter Ryan. In Adelaide, there's a battle to save one of the few city pubs that still hosts live music most nights. Campaigners say development laws fail to account for its cultural importance. Angus Randall reports.
Adelaide band Bad Dreams has toured the world, but they started out more than 10 years ago playing front bars and back rooms of pubs, including the Crown and Anchor in the city's CBD.
It's definitely a nice, interesting, hot, sweaty venue. It's quite intimate. I mean, if you don't have a lot of fans, you can play in front of 15 and it still feels pretty good in there.
Guitarist Alastair Wells has played plenty of gigs at the Crown and Anchor, which has been serving pints since the 1850s and hosts live music most nights of the week. But it could soon be calling last drinks. If a development application is approved, it may be turned into up to 15 stories of student housing. Adelaide, like most cities, is facing a student housing shortage, but musicians like Alastair Wells say it would be a major blow to Adelaide's live music scene.
It's really hard because, you know, lots of people would say, oh, you know, you could just move those gigs somewhere else, or, you know, or maybe they could just, you know, set that venue up somewhere else. But at the end of the day, that's not really possible.
The Crown and Anchor is heritage listed, so the building is protected from being flattened. But there are concerns the facade would be kept while the pub is shut down. Greens State Upper House member Robert Sims wants the government to step in.
One of the big problems that we have in South Australia in terms of heritage protection is that it only considers the bricks and mortar. It doesn't actually consider what goes on within the particular site.
Today, he's moving a motion in state parliament calling for heritage laws to consider cultural and social value alongside a building's history.
In effect, it doesn't mean that you can't redevelop a site or do anything with it, but it does mean that if you're assessing a development application, you'd need to consider the social and cultural value of the site as well, rather than just simply the facade of the bricks and mortar. Because if you looked at something like the Crown and Anchor, for instance, if you were to just gut the interior, turn it into student accommodation, and you just keep the facade, that's not really the point of the heritage.
State Planning Minister Nick Champion has been contacted for comment. Historian Dr. James Lesh is from conservation consultancy Heritage Workshop. He says heritage laws across the country struggle to account for a building's cultural importance.
The best way to protect a heritage pub is to have a sympathetic owner or owners group who want to continue to maintain the use and cultural life of that place. Unfortunately, the Australian planning systems are not particularly good at enabling or incentivising sympathetic groups to own these sorts of places.
The state government's State Commission Assessment Panel will make the decision on the pub's future later this year. Dr. Lesh says it's rare that a government would step in to block a development of this size, but it may be the only way to protect culturally important sites.
If we want to see that these well-located, popular venues are protected into the future, the government will have to intervene in some way. whether that means covenants and restrictive planning laws, whether that means enabling community purchase of these sites, or if that means the government taking them over, that's the only way forward. Otherwise, we will lose all these sites.
Bad Dreams are still proudly an Adelaide band, but Alastair Wells says without smaller venues like the Crown and Anchor to play, the next generation will head elsewhere.
It kind of sucks out your young youth talent because you can't make it in a town if there's not enough scene and there's not enough people supporting, you know, what you do.
Bad Dreams guitarist Alastair Wells, Angus Randall reporting. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Rachel Mealy.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Drugs, sex and lavish dinners out. News organisations paying for interviews is hardly new, but the allegations about what Channel 7's Spotlight program gave to Bruce Lehrman for a sit-down interview are surprising to say the least. Today, Media Watch host Paul Barry unpacks what's unfolded. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.